Brexit. What a mess. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Still no consensus on Brexit, and Brits are losing their cool.
We are angry. You have let British business down.
Also, historical wrongs and how to make up for them.
The motivation for asking for an apology isn't to revise everyone's version of history.
Plus, Latinx viewers determined to bring back the TV show one day at a time.
My dad was the one who introduced me to this show. He called me and he was like, "You need to watch this show. This is us. This is literally every single person in our family. You need to watch it."
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. All we know about tomorrow is it's called Friday. That's a quote from one British lawmaker today when asked what's happening tomorrow with Brexit. Because tomorrow is March 29th, and that was supposed to be the date Britain exited the European Union. But after nearly 3 years of talks, votes, and parliamentary motions, British lawmakers and Prime Minister Theresa May still can't agree on how to make that happen, or even what's happening tomorrow by the sounds of things. The World's Orla Barry has been following all the twists and turns from London.
We're coming to the end of yet another chaotic week. But although it feels like we've been here before, there's one key difference this week. This time, the Prime Minister's job is on the line, and she may have played what could be her final card, offering to resign as long as Parliament approves her Brexit withdrawal deal.
We have a deal which cancels our EU membership fee, which stops the EU making our laws, which gives us our own immigration policy.
Initially, May's offer to resign drew support from some of her most ardent foes. Boris Johnson, who's long eyed the Conservative leadership, announced he'd changed his mind on the deal. A deal, he once said, wrapped a suicide vest around the British Constitution and handed the detonator to the EU. Others have followed, but maybe not enough. Here's another right-wing Conservative, Marc Francois, speaking outside the Houses of Parliament today.
Let me speak plainly, right? The withdrawal agreement means that we do not leave the European Union. I will never go through the lobbies of the House of Commons and surrender my country to anybody. And with respect, what bit of that don't you understand?
The right wing of Theresa May's party is a problem. But an even bigger problem are her coalition partners, the Northern Ireland-based Democratic Unionist Party.
It's impossible for us to sign up to the withdrawal agreement. And you know what? I regret that.
Arlene Foster is party leader.
Because we wanted to get a deal that worked for the whole of the United Kingdom, a deal that worked for Northern Ireland. But now we're in a situation where we cannot sign up to the withdrawal agreement.
So what now? Well, if we know one thing about British Prime Minister May, she doesn't give up easily. News today is that Parliament is likely to vote on a version of her deal once again, for the third time, after two defeats. And if the third time ends in failure, well, opposition and backbench MPs may take control of Parliament against Theresa May's wishes. If that all sounds familiar, well, it's because they tried that already this week. MPs were presented with eight options on eight possible scenarios, ranging from another referendum to a different kind of customs union with Europe to no deal at all. The result of each vote, though, sounded something like this.
The ayes were 184, the noes were 293. The ayes were 237, the noes were 307. The ayes were 268. Yes! The noes were 295. Yes!
By now, everyone in Britain is deeply frustrated with the entire Brexit process and embarrassed too. Business leaders are furious. The Conservative Party has always been seen as one that favours business. But this was the message from the head of the British Chambers of Commerce, Adam Marshall, today.
We are angry. You have let British business down. 3 years going round in circles. Ladies and gentlemen, 3 years is long enough. Too many critical questions, ladies and gentlemen, remain unanswered. No one would run a business like this, and it is no way to run a country.
European Union leaders are also running out of patience. And if British politicians can't get their act together and vote for a plan, well, Britain could be staring over the cliff face once again on April 12th. And face the prospect of leaving the European Union without a divorce agreement. But that's 15 days away. And if you've learnt anything about the British Parliament and the Brexit process, you'll know a lot can happen in 15 days. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The moment Theresa May became Britain's Prime Minister 2 years ago, her attention has been mostly focused on making Brexit a reality.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move. OK, you may say that, but you should hear Jean-Claude Juncker's voice as a result of our conversation.
May didn't cause a crisis. In fact, she was against the UK divorce from the European Union, but she's been pressured to fix it. This is not specific to Theresa May or politics, by the way. Women are more often given the chance to lead in times of crisis. Alison Cook studies this trend at Utah State University. I mean, it's kind of like, what an opportunity. Here's a big fat mess. You fix it. Are there certain traits that show women are actually better in risky crisis situations?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why this phenomenon happens. One is the fact of, yes, it's a messy situation. So, you know, a traditional white male leader might say, why on earth would I want to be a leader in this situation? It's set up for failure. I'm starting at a deficit. I don't want this. I'll have another opportunity. Where a white woman or a person of color might say, this might be my only shot at, you know, having this leadership role. That's one reason. The other is, as you suggested, a sort of a stereotypical view of women. And there's actually been research done that says that people perceive women to be better in a crisis situation. Now, it might be because they're more empathetic, might be that they're perceived to be more consensus building, more loyal, maybe more participative leadership style.
In a crisis, are women held to the same expectations as men?
Women are under far more scrutiny when they are in these leadership roles than men. Just because there are so few women, it's such a rare occurrence to have a woman leading a country, a company, in this situation that they're far more visible. And they tend to actually have less authority and support. And I think in the Theresa May situation, that's especially clear given how her party has challenged her regularly throughout this process.
So, Theresa May, obviously a good example of this. Where else have you seen this phenomenon? When in history have you seen it?
Oh, this phenomenon is far too frequent. My colleague and I joke often that it's disheartening to see this happening over and over, but it also provides our job security since this is an area we research. You know, there are examples everywhere. I mean, the Icelandic prime minister was appointed right after the financial crisis,
right.
And she actually led beautifully throughout that and succeeded well. Mm. And so, you know, there are these international examples, plenty of examples throughout the U.S. that Dr. Glass and I have studied.
And when you look at the patterns, what happens after the crisis has passed? Are these women generally going to stay on in power or positions of power?
After the crisis has passed, some of these women have succeeded and done very well. You know, Mary Barra at General Motors is touted as being an exceptional CEO today, and she definitely led GM out of this crisis. And you have others that have succeeded. But often these women, when they don't succeed, they get derailed from their career. They don't have other opportunities, and they sort of just fade away. And then they bring in a term that we came up with, the savior effect. They bring back in that traditional white male CEO. Mm.
So, Alison, just to wrap things up, I don't want you to give us your take on Brexit because it's confusing to people everywhere. But what is your take on how Theresa May has navigated this crisis?
You know, Theresa May's situation is such an extreme example of the glass cliff. Here is something that she was not in favor of. You know, she was one of the few people, along with another woman at the time, to say, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and take over and try to lead Britain out of this crisis. You know, whether you're in support of Theresa May or not, she was put in a very, very difficult position and without the support really to navigate this effectively.
And now she's saying she'll resign, she'll step down if Brexit is passed. I mean, isn't that the quintessential kind of conclusion to this glass cliff story?
Absolutely.
Alison Cook, professor of management at Utah State University, talking about the glass cliff. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Leaders in Europe and here in the U.S. continue to wrestle with a common challenge, what to do with efforts to hack or interfere with their respective countries' elections. And that's put tech companies like Facebook in the spotlight on both sides of the Atlantic.
It's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well.
That's Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg testifying before Congress last year.
Our position is not that regulation is bad. I think the real question is, what is the right framework for this, not should there be one?
One thing is certain. In Europe, the framework for reining in high tech is taking shape faster than here. Margrethe Vestager is the European Commissioner for Competition. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Can I ask you, first of all, what does your title actually mean? Commissioner for Competition.
Well, it means that I'm the law enforcer. So it's my job to have the leadership of the law enforcement of European competition law.
And you've been in that position since 2014. What does that mean practically when you're looking at U.S. high-tech companies like Google? I mean, Google searches account for like 9 out of 10 searches in the EU, correct?
That's correct, yes. And everyone is welcome to do business in Europe, no matter the flag you're flying, where you have your home. But you will have to do business according to the European rulebook when in Europe. And this is why when someone complains, when we ourselves get a suspicion that something is wrong, we start investigating.
And what do you consider like something that is wrong? What would you start to investigate?
Well, take the first Google case. Here you have a company which is dominant in search, which has then used search to promote its own shopping comparison service and demote rivals in shopping comparison services, on average to page 4. And this is a misuse of your success to be dominant. You're more than welcome to be successful, but if you do become dominant, you get a special responsibility. You know, the more power you have, the stronger your responsibility.
So the EU has fined Google 3 times in recent years. The most recent came down last week, a fine of $1.7 billion. Are these fines meant to be big enough to dissuade companies from repeating their wrongdoing? Or like in the case of Google, do they just see this as the cost of doing business?
Well, there are a number of functions when we take a decision. One is to fine past behavior. Second, to say, well, you got to stop what you did and you cannot do anything to the equivalent. And then, of course, to start remedying the marketplace. What we see now after the Google shopping decision is that the shopping unit, the shopping box, has been opened to rivals. So now I think in 3 out of 4 searches for a product, you would find rivals in the shopping box. And in 40% of clicks on a product, that click would go to a rival of Google's, to a merchant that is not in sort of in the Google universe. So you see that the market is improving.
It seems there are really 2 big issues here. I mean, the monopoly trend that seems to dominate high tech and also the privacy problems. Which is more important to you as a regulator, as the Commissioner for Competition in the EU?
Well, competition legislation is it's a very strong tool. But just because that you have a very big hammer, you shouldn't think that everything is a nail. And I think it is important that competition law enforcement works with regulation, because you cannot do everything by competition tools. You need also the marketplace to be framed by, for instance, privacy issues, copyright issues, in order for this not to turn into something Wild West, where you basically just see the consumer as part of your product.
Margrethe Vestager, you're the former Deputy Prime Minister of Denmark. Some people will hear your comments and say that, you know, the biggest, most successful firms in the world came from countries with the least rigid regulations. Do you think regulation stifles the innovation we all want?
No, I don't think so. I think regulation works as an incentive. Of course, it very much depends on your state of mind. If you just want completely open space to innovate, or you sort of say, well, I consider this to be things that I will build in. I will do, for instance, privacy by design instead of as an add-on to say, oh, well, privacy. I'll add on something more or less superficial in the end. Instead of saying, of course, I respect the privacy of the people who will use my services. Mm. So this is my starting point.
Margrethe Vestager, the European Commissioner for Competition. Great to meet you. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure being here. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Netflix has over 10,000 shows on its site, so why, ask many Latinx people here in the U.S., is it dropping the one show they feel truly reflects their own lives and concerns? The show Netflix canceled after just 3 seasons is One Day at a Time, a reboot of the 1970s show with the same name. The new version centers on 3 generations of one Cuban-American family living under one roof. Netflix said not enough people were watching it. But viewers are angry, and they've launched a campaign to find a way to save the show. We asked one fan here in Boston to tell us what this new One Day at a Time means to her.
My name is Adriana Zuniga. I am Mexican and Guatemalan. I'm 22. This is it.
One Day at a Time is a whirlwind of living in a Latinx family.
I get it, we're Cuban!
Azúcar!
It's so funny because my dad was the one who introduced me to this show. He called me and he was like, you need to watch this show. It is so funny. This is us. This is literally every single person in our family. You need to watch it.
Did you find Abuelita?
Yeah, she's with Jesus now.
What?
Oh, no, sorry. She's at church. That poor choice of words.
And then I watched the first episode and I was hooked. It was so funny. I think what's so successful about it is the levels of comedy and the Spanglish that's used that is so identifiable within our community. And it's Rita Moreno is a star. Like, how can you not laugh with Rita Moreno?
She has to have a quinces. How else will we know the day that our little girl becomes a woman?
One Day at a Time touches upon colorism, where you see Alex, who's a lot darker than Elena, who is white passing. It's a similar experience with me too, because my brother is a little darker than me too. Luckily, I haven't experienced racial slurs, but my brother has. His gym teacher called him Pancho Villa. It was like, she called him Pancho. It means you're not a person. It just means you are blending into the background, that you don't matter. There's definitely a lot more resentment towards my brother, because I think my brother was fooling around with his friends, but they were just joking around, and the teacher took it seriously towards the only Mexican in the group. And I think watching One Day at a Time has really sparked that interest in how do we talk about these things. It was so great to see those really difficult issues being shown on a screen. The only Latinx family TV show that I ever really knew growing up was George Lopez.
Who's bigger? It's mostly hair.
And then other than that, I didn't really have any other exposure. I've only known about, like, actual telenovelas.
Artemio Hidalgo falleció al amanecer, señor.
Víctima de on Univision or Telemundo. But I don't ever see that on TV. And now that One Day at a Time is on Netflix, like, that was revolutionary to me. It's really upsetting that Netflix wants to whitewash our story and blame the numbers. Our community is so used to being rejected and denied, including the Dreamers and everything that's going on within our community in this political climate. It honestly raises the question, how do we tell our stories and who allows us to tell our stories?
One Day at a Time fan, Adriana Zuniga there. Arlene Davila is with me. She's the director of the Latinx Project at NYU. She studies media culture there. So we just heard Adriana mention comedian George Lopez and telenovelas. And I'm just wondering, Arlene, what's different for you about One Day at a Time that Latinx viewers here in the U.S. feel really represents them?
Yeah, I think she nailed it. Listening to her is basically what listening to my students and listening to any other Latinx cultural activist and what they have been saying for the past 20 or so years. Because what you have is a media that has historically imported programming. And they basically, the approach has been, let's just import telenovelas, let's import Latin American content, which is oftentimes cheaper to produce, is already ready packed, and you've taken care of the Latinx population in the United States. So that's been the big issue, is that any Latin thing will do for Latinx audiences. And that myth has been going on for decades. And it's a myth that has to do with economics and what's more commercially profitable, but it has nothing to do with the Latinx population living in the United States, what our stories are, or anything else.
What do the statistics say about Latinx representation on TV and in Hollywood?
Oh, it's non-existent. You have to start with the fact that 18% of the population in the United States is Latinx. So I can assure you that you don't have 18% or anything close to that. In fact, the numbers according to the Latino Media Gap, which is the report, most recent report, Latinx accounts for 2.3% of directors and 2.2% producers and 6% of writers. But actually, when you look closely at those statistics, you will see that they aggregated also Latin American directors. Mm. So in fact, the content, the amount of productions that are being authored by Latinx producers, writers, and actors is even less. It's more minimal.
What about a series like Narcos or movies like Roma? Should they count when it comes to Latinx representation?
Absolutely no. And that's one of the biggest things that that everybody needs to understand.
Why not?
Is that there's a big difference between Latinx and Latin American productions. And I'm all for more Latin American productions. I love to watch the TV shows that come from Argentina and from Colombia and Mexico. Some of them, actually, not all. But that's all you see.
So there's what you're saying, there's a lack of representation of the lives of Latinx people living in the United States and their daily concerns, their lives.
Latinx are totally invisible. And one of the other problems is that when you have all this imported programming, they have a very different representation of the world. Latin American productions have historically been extremely whitewashed. If you see the Mexican shows that have been that Netflix has been producing, they're focusing on the upper middle classes, very light skin actors, and or the narco genre, of course. They don't have the sensitivity that One Day at a Time had in representing concerns around colorism, around the issues that Latinx populations in the context of the United States have to face.
So as Netflix cancels One Day at a Time and turns its focus to South America and the markets there, I mean, what gives you hope?
I think what gives me hope is the activism that I've seen, new voices that are speaking out on this issue, really stating very clearly that it's wonderful that we have all these Mexican directors and producers, but hey, they're not us, right? My students are not confused. Mm-hmm. And they
sure
want jobs, and they're writing beautiful things, and they're doing incredible creative work. And we need to begin to really focus on the Latinx cultural creators, the artists, the producers who are here. That gives me hope.
Arlene Davila, director of the Latinx Project at NYU, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, intruders broke into the North Korean embassy in Spain, and then things turned weird.
Three of the intruders are believed to have taken the most senior official who was there into the basement of the building, at which point two of them tried to persuade him to abandon North Korea.
We'll explain. That's ahead here on The World. New details emerge this week about a dissident group that authorities say broke into the North Korean embassy in Madrid, in Spain. Spanish authorities are seeking to extradite two alleged members of this group, one of whom is a U.S. citizen. The World's Amulya Shankar has been following this story. So what have you found out?
Well, there's not a ton of information out there about this group, Marco. Most people don't actually want to speak on the record about them. But here's what we do know. Giulima Civil Defense is named after a winged horse in East Asian mythology. It's also known as Free Joseon, which is the North Korean word for their country. And this group's goal is to overthrow the Kim dynasty that's been in power for decades.
So the Giulima Civil Defense, how are they doing at that goal about overthrowing the Kim dynasty?
Well, we don't know exactly how long they've been operating or what exactly they've been doing, but most of the international community learned about them in 2017. Remember when Kim Jong-nam, the brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, was assassinated in Malaysia?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Giulima Civil Defense claims it was able to get his son, Kim Han-sol, to safety in an unknown location. And this was a huge deal because Kim Han-sol has criticized his uncle's regime, which is definitely not okay in North Korea.
Yeah.
And there's been speculation that Giulima Civil Defense is made up of exiles and others with the power and influence to fund and help the group from other countries like the U.S. But again, this is speculation, and the organization has been laying pretty low until this raid on the North Korean embassy in Spain back in February.
Yeah, it is a mysterious and murky situation. The World's Amulya Shankar, thanks for staying on top of this.
Thank you.
To hear more about the details we did learn this week, I talked to Isla Binney. She's a Reuters reporter in Madrid.
The Spanish court, which has been investigating the incident on February 22nd, they say that effectively a group, including a man who is believed to be a long-term activist for freedom in North Korea, this particular man approached the embassy. He actually managed to gain access by knocking on the door and asking to see a member of embassy staff. He was allowed in, and then while he was waiting, he opened the door and let in some companions of his who were outside, who came in and, according to the Spanish court, then began to beat and tie up the embassy staff.
There was also another detail I spotted, that this group of activists wanted a North Korean official inside the embassy to defect.
Yes, absolutely. So sometime after the initial entry of all of these people, three of the intruders are believed to have taken the most senior official who was there into the basement of the building, at which point two of them tried to persuade him to abandon North Korea, and they identified themselves as members of an organization which described its mission as being for the liberation of North Korea.
So we're seeing that this North Korean dissident group called the Cheol Lima Civil Defense has taken responsibility for the raid on this embassy in Madrid. What do we know about their motives? I mean, did they take anything from the embassy?
The motives of the group remains pretty shadowy. But in terms of the specific events in Madrid, the Spanish court believes that they took away two pen drives and computers and a mobile telephone. We don't know really anything else about what they were expecting to find.
So the Spanish government has identified 10 people, it says, were part of this raid. Who are they?
So the court says that it believes a group of 10 people conducted the raid. They name seven, and the one about whom we seem to have the most information is Adrian Hong Chang, a Mexican who is a US resident, and he's believed to be a long-time activist, and he's also among the older members of the group.
Mm. Are they all residents of the US?
The Spanish court believes that five of them are back in the US, that five of them returned after the raid. So that would be Adrian Hong Chang and a person who's actually a US citizen named Sam Ryu. And then there were three other people for whom Adrian Hong Chang is believed to have paid hotel accommodation for in the US. But the US State Department has been adamant that the US government was not involved. And the FBI says that it is their standard practice not to even say whether an investigation is ongoing.
So what's next in this mysterious case on the Spanish side?
Well, the Spanish government, as far as I'm aware, has not commented on this incident. This is something which in Spain is currently being dealt with by the court that we mentioned, which has the mandate to investigate this kind of incident and has now requested extradition for two people named in this report, the group leader and the US citizen. I think at this point, the judicial authorities in both countries have to be in contact. We understand that there could be more specific warrants issued in the course of their work on this case, but it's very hard for us to say at this point whether extradition could end up actually being arranged.
Reporter Isla Binney with Reuters in Madrid. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Spain's been in the news this week for another reason, because of something Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said. He's demanding that Spain apologize to Mexico for its actions in the colonial era. Spain said no. Now the two countries are in a face-off. Making amends for historical wrongs is also something that's playing out in Germany this week. One of that country's richest families is donating millions of dollars to charity after a newspaper found that their ancestors supported Hitler and used forced labor under the Nazis. All of this got us thinking about apologies, how often they happen, and what goes into the decision to make one. The World's Alison Herrera and Rupa Shenoy are with me to talk this through. Hey, Alison. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Marco.
Hi, Marco.
What was the general reaction to that Mexico-Spain disagreement?
There were a lot of different reactions. Some people were outraged that Spain wouldn't apologize, of course. Others argued that colonialism had benefits for Mexican people. There was another group that said Mexico was unfairly holding Spain accountable for past actions. Some pointed out that López Obrador is of European ancestry and asked what right he had to ask for an apology. People responded to that by saying Mexico shouldn't have to wait for an indigenous president
to ask for an apology.
Yeah, so a real mixed bag, suggesting something of a controversial topic. So how often does something like this happen? How many governments have apologized in cases of historical wrongdoing?
Marco, it's happening more and more. Just earlier this month, the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, you know, he's become known for his apologies. And he flew up north to Nunavut during a snowstorm. You know, it's really cold up there. He apologized to the Inuit people for how Canada treated them during the tuberculosis epidemic in the 1940s and 50s.
The government's management of TB wasn't one bad policy. It was only a piece of the larger history of destructive colonialism.
I spoke with an elder and former Canadian politician, Jack Anowak. He's Inuit. His mom went missing during the tuberculosis epidemic.
What I'm hoping to see is a concerted effort to look for the people that went down south in the 40s and 50s for treatment for either tuberculosis and other illnesses, and put a program together that will seriously look at finding those places so that we can have some closure on this issue.
So, Allison, in that case, what has Justin Trudeau's government done to address this?
Well, it turns out that there's a database that's in the works. It's supposed to go online next year. It's called Nanalivut, which means let's find them. And it contains medical records. So people like Anowak can actually search that and find where his mother is buried.
So you could say that is a form of reparation. I mean, a lot of people see reparation also as a monetary figure, whatever the form. How meaningful are apologies without reparations, Rupa?
If they're done right, apologies can be important mechanisms for countries to acknowledge their pasts and move forward. I talked to Ruben Carranza at the International Center for Transnational Justice. They work on cases involving apologies that come before the International Criminal Court. He uses the example of Chile. In 1991, a National Truth Commission released a report about crimes under the Pinochet dictatorship. And in response, the Chilean president went on TV to apologize.
The president, in effect, set the tone and set the example for acknowledgement. And it was followed by the head of the army of Chile, mostly responsible for many of those violations as an institution. So these are elements that combine together become a turning point.
And Rupa, when I asked you how meaningful are apologies without reparations, you said if they're done right, what is the right way to make an apology then?
The consensus seems to be that it has to be unequivocal. It has to take responsibility. And it has to be clear about what it's an apology for, which doesn't always happen. All of that has to be done really publicly and ideally involve a lot of people. And people cite the example of Sorry Day in Australia. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I have.
It's May 26th. For 20 years, they've had ceremonies, marches, speeches on that day to express regret for the historical mistreatment of Aboriginal people.
All right, let's circle back and pull this all together. Allison, how often are apologies followed up by real action?
Well, overall, it's a mixed bag, Marco. And what happens often is that there has to be a lawsuit for there to be reparations. So, for example, the United States did apologize to Native Americans in 2010. But that apology was tucked away in a massive Defense Appropriations Act on page 45. For that to happen, tribes have to sue the federal government. And that was the case in Cobell versus Salazar, which was a successful class action lawsuit brought about by Eloise Cobell that proved the U.S. had mismanaged Indian trust funds, and they came to a settlement.
Right, so it can happen. All right, Allison, Rupa, there are a lot of other questions I could ask right now, but I'm going to stop there. You're both watching this, so I look forward to hearing more about what you find out. The World's Allison Herrera and Rupa Shenoy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's this new service you might have heard of. It's called Rent-A-Fin. No, not that kind of fin. This kind of fin.
Hi, my name is Katya.
Katya is one of the voices you hear in Finland's new campaign to have Finns host foreigners and show them the country, or rent a Finn. The UN rated Finland the happiest country in the world. Jesse Karjalainen is a Finnish author living in the UK. He wrote a book about Finland's can-do mindset. What do you think about this rent a Finn service, Jesse?
I think it's quite a novel approach, really. Rather than just being a visitor or a tourist or being a pen pal, even if that still exists. I think renting a Finn, going and living and staying with a living, breathing Finn and getting to know one and their environment is a pretty good idea.
A living, breathing Finn. Well, you're one of those, but you live in the UK. What makes Finland the happiest country on earth? What do you tell people in the UK?
I think it's a combination. It's a funny word, this happiness versus obviously synonym for comfort, satisfaction and well-being, that type of thing, rather than happy, clappy, joke-telling comedians. I think that's probably the first thing I tell people, if there's any misconception there.
Stop you right there. What is the difference between happiness and being happy?
Okay, so happiness, obviously... Sorry, let me just...
Are you going to the dictionary now?
No. I'm just... The whole thing started with the World Happiness Report coming out from the UN. And I don't know if you know, but actually this is the second year that Finland has won in a row. And I remember last year when the news came out, the instant reaction in Finland was there's got to be some mistake.
Yeah, I mean, Finns have this reputation of being, well, I won't say dour, but at least self-deprecating. And yet they live in the happiest country in the world. How does that actually work?
Exactly. Then that's where that contradiction came as news to people in Finland. Exactly that. Yeah, they are. There's no shame in the word dour, no shame in the word silent, reticent. They are quiet like that, but they're very warm at the same time. So there is that apparent contradiction there.
So the book you wrote is called Sisu, subtitled The Secrets of Finland's Can-Do Mindset. Do you see any kind of contradiction in Sisu, this determination and happiness?
No. Sisu is it's a Finnish word that every Finn grows up knowing. The sisu part of sort of determination and resilience and that type of thing is about seeking to achieve your goals and seeking to, you know, set some goals. I do have a proverb in my book, a Finnish proverb, which says that happiness does not come from happiness itself, but from the journey towards achieving it. And I think that's kind of relates a little bit to sisu and having resilience and setting goals and that type of thing.
If we were both in Helsinki, I mean, you're in the UK, but if we were both in Helsinki and you were my rent-a-fin, what would you want to show me?
I think the first thing you do notice when you come to Finland, let alone Helsinki, the capital city, is how quiet and calm things are. Maybe that's just me coming from the UK, but it's unbelievably calm, relaxed, and quiet.
You'd take me to nature, we'd sit on a bench and just absorb it and be quiet.
Well, this is part of the thing about the happiness, and I guess the Rent-A-Finn program as well. I mean, obviously I'm not involved with that directly, but the whole premise of coming to Finland is really exploring nature as medicine, if you want to call it that. You know, escape from the busy world, take time to reflect, to focus, to think, and just really just breathe and relax.
Jesse Karjalainen, Finnish author living in the UK. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Drama on the high seas today. It started when a group of migrants adrift in the Mediterranean was rescued by a passing oil tanker. But the tanker was bound for Libya. That's where the migrants had come from. So when they realized where they were headed, some of the migrants seized control of the tanker. Then they forced it to head towards Europe. The armed forces of Malta finally took back control of the ship. The migrants disembarked in Malta, although four or five men were seen being taken into police custody with their hands bound. Martin Davis is director of the Maritime Law Center at Tulane University. Professor Davis, the Italian government has denounced the seizure of the ship by the migrants as an act of piracy. And we don't know all the details yet, but what is your sense and what questions would need to be answered to clarify this case?
Well, I doubt very much that it would count as piracy in the technical sense. One view of piracy is that it is confined to acts committed for personal gain, making money. But it really doesn't matter whether it constitutes piracy in the technical sense, because it is clearly a violation of an international convention known as the Suppression of Unlawful Acts Convention. It's usually called the SUA Convention for short, which makes it a criminal offence to seize control of a ship by force or by threat of force or by any other form of intimidation.
So advocacy groups say the migrants were pretty fearful of mistreatment if they were returned to Libya, and they argue that they were, in effect, acting in self-defence. That seems ethical, but could it be used in court?
Unfortunately not, or rather unfortunately for them, not. The SUA Convention, which creates this offence, and the SUA Convention has been adopted by 156 countries around the world. It creates this offence, which has been made an offence by each of those 156 countries, including Malta and Italy and Turkey. It has no defences in the convention. So even if someone seizes or exercises control over a ship by force for very good reason, as these people say they have, that's not a defense. There is no defense, unfortunately, for them.
And how did that convention come into being in the first place?
It was passed as a result of the hijacking of the Achille Lauro, an Italian cruise ship that was seized by PLO terrorists in 1985.
Right.
And it revealed the fact that there was not really an adequate international law treatment of seizure of a ship for something other than personal gain. So pirates typically are after money in some form or another. The PLO terrorists in that case were not after money. They just wanted to seize the vessel. So the Sewer Convention was designed to deal with that situation, which is people taking over a vessel for their own, well, in that case, political purposes, but not for financial gain. And sadly for these people, it fits to a T what they have done.
I mean, we've heard terrible cases of sub-Saharan Africans migrating through Libya and being put into slavery. Won't prosecutors take that into account?
Look, they may. If they're prosecuted either in Malta or in Turkey, the court may take into account that they have what they say is very good reason for seizing the vessel, and that may be reflected in whatever sentence they're given. But from the facts as I've seen them so far, there seems to be little doubt that this is exactly the kind of thing that the Sewer Convention deals with.
Just a matter of protocol, in a previous case in November last year, some migrants adrift at sea claimed that six ships had passed them by before they were rescued. Mm. We could not verify that claim, but what are ships supposed to do?
Oh, absolutely, definitely to pick them up. There are several sources of international law obligation that say that ships have an obligation to give aid to persons in distress at sea. The United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea says it. There's another convention called the Salvage Convention that contains a provision of that kind. There's no doubt that the ship is supposed to pick them up.
And if those ships can be identified, what would happen to the masters of the ship?
Unfortunately, very little. You mean the ships that failed to pick them up?
Right.
Again, it would be a question for the country of the flag, the country of registry of the ship where the master did not perform the obligation that he or she was supposed to perform. And I would think that most flag states would not choose to prosecute the master in those circumstances. But it would be for that country to decide.
Martin Davis is a professor of maritime law at Tulane University. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
A hot destination that's generally pretty cold is taking a hit in the tourism department, Iceland. By now, you probably have heard that Iceland's budget airline, WOW, shut down suddenly last night, leaving thousands of passengers stranded in North America and Europe.
When we came to the airport, we were supposed to fly to Frankfurt. When we came here, they were saying the flight got cancelled and nobody received any kind of email communication. So we are just stranded here. And now we were checking the flights. They are $800, $900. Like, we can't afford to, you know, buy those tickets. But then we'll have to do it. But it's so much pain.
Nearly a third of visitors to Iceland flew with WOW. And now there are fears that the island's important tourist sector will take a direct hit. The woes don't end with WOW. The second bad news story for Iceland tourism this week has to do with Justin Bieber. Bieber's I'll Show You music video was shot on location at the lush Fjallaráa-Glúr Canyon in Iceland. That six-syllable word means rock, by the way. The waterfall, the steep, mossy hillsides, the Bieb, it all attracted way more tourists than the site could handle. Before the 2015 video was released, the canyon didn't see many tourists. After the video, tourism there spiked, and the Environmental Agency of Iceland closed the spot twice to give it a chance to recover. But the popularity has not abated. Authorities said this week they're closing the canyon now for a few months. Too many people walking on the fragile vegetation. Believers, Instagram influencers, and YouTubers have all been filling up our social feeds with snaps of blue lagoons and foggy beaches for some time now. Adventure and travel vlogger Johnny Harris says there are a lot of reasons for this spike of visitors, but it started with the 2008 economic crisis.
The entire world was affected by the meltdown, but Iceland was perhaps hit the hardest of any country. Because of that, the currency took a huge hit. Suddenly your dollar or your euro could stretch a lot further. So a lot of people started to come here simply because it was much cheaper.
Suddenly there was way more filming and social media. People felt a need to go. And cheap flights, looking at you, wow, made it easier to get there.
I spent $99 on this flight from Baltimore to Iceland direct.
Harris says it's not just hype.
The real reason why Iceland is having a boom is because it's amazing and beautiful. Is it too
late now to say sorry? Now, I can't argue with that. Last word today goes to Bieber. I don't know if sorry will cut it for Iceland, but it is a decent way to end the show. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.